red district, that kind of thing?
Well, there was no red district. It was just one block, and it's right at the end of North Beach. It was within shouting distance of the Onion and the Hungry Eye.
Ah.
But, of course, we never went there. It was like neon lights and flashing lights and strobes, you know, and all kinds of shit happening all the time, and pimps and whores and strippers walking up and down. It's just one block.
Now, you're talking about this, you know, gross nightclub owner. You go to Bergen, and then you come back. You're talking about, well, the Hugh Hefner and nightclub owner, plus this other guy who creates or runs or has the Holiday.
Well, I had gotten Ann Johnny Mathis after the Holloway closed. He went to Ann's 440. So she was very happy because Johnny was a big draw. So when I mentioned Lenny Bruce to her, she figured, why not? The other act she had, which he was totally fabulous, was a female impersonator who was not gay, by the way, named T.C. Jones. Unbelievable.
Did he become well known?
Yes, he was in, what was that, musical on Broadway. It's kind of a cabaret thing that will happen every few years. I can't remember.
The Liza Minnelli thing?
No. This is a famous impresario who had it every few years. I can't remember. But anyway, T.C. was fantastic. He was married. He had a very nice wife, and he had...
You don't mean the Follies Bergers?
No. I'm talking about New York. They had two Siamese cats. I remember Anne had Siamese cats.
Okay, so into Lenny.
So Lenny is at Anne's 440, and I take half and this nightclub owner there, and they laugh their heads off, and the guy hires Lenny on the spot.
For a Chicago nightclub.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that was the beginning of the end for Lenny.
Now, why is it the end for him?
Because it's there that he gets into junk.
In Chicago?
Yes.
At that performance, or that gig? You think it's that gig that begins it?
Yeah, I think so.
So you regret, as a friend, introducing him to Hugh Hefner?
I regret that just the same way that I regret having introduced Marshall to Howard Gossage.
Yeah, Marshall McLuhan, right. Well, we'll get into that later.
I know, but I mean, it was the same kind of mistake.
Right. You see McLuhan, he didn't get into junk, but how does that hurt McLuhan?
He did get into junk. Not heroin, but he got into Howard Gossage's junk, you know.
Well, that was publicity, and it made...
I know, but it was terrible, you know. It took him out of the world that he was, and it put him into a world which he kind of was exuberant about, but I don't think it was a positive input for the next few years of what he might have written.
Okay, well, let's hold that thought when we get to McLuhan. We're talking about McLuhan, listeners, not Lenny in this part. And,
okay.
McLuhan becomes, he gets on the cover of Newsweek and Tom Wolfe writes an article. That was all planned by Howard Gossage and with Tom Wolfe as the first seduced person for that publicity campaign by Gossage. That's what you're referring to.
Yes, yeah. Gossage and his sidekick, Alvin Toffler.
Who's sidekick?
Gossage's.
Was Toffler. Okay, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Because, you know, Ted Carpenter, who you eventually got to know, he agrees with you in terms of what Gossage did to McLuhan, and he was at the meetings with Gossage and watched them plan and was disgusted by it, and then a few weeks later all the articles started coming out on McLuhan.
Yeah. I'm sure that's right, although I wasn't at those meetings.
Right.
I mean, I introduced them in San Francisco, where Howard lived in an old firehouse.
Right, and you knew Howard through this world that you're in the late 50s.
Absolutely.
The public relations world. Did you know him back then, at that early, in the late 50s?
I knew him at the same time I knew Herb Cain and through Ann and, you know,
right.
That whole social scene, yes.
Okay, so Lenny Bruce, that's a story about that period, and that is when you're with Ann?
Yep.
Right. So then, what?
Well, it starts out when I'm with Maya, but it translates into Ann, yes.
So, when you went to Chicago and visited Hefner in this period, did he have his mansion at that point? You remember being
in? Not that I remember. No, I always met him in his office.
Right, and you found him gross. I mean, when he was handing out dollar bills and running around San Francisco, did that image stick with you? Did you change your view of him?
No, not then. You know, I mean, I worked with Speck.
Why did you admire Speck?
Oh, because he was a fantastic writer. He could write anywhere on anything. He had a little Olivetti that he carried around with him. And he wrote the Arlene Francis shows, and he wrote the book called The Exurbanites.
Right.
Which I thought was a very good book. And he was extremely sophisticated in all ways, and a very smart fellow, and his wife, Theo. Hefner kept recruiting him, and, you know, they were New Yorkers, and Speck kept saying no, and then eventually not only did he offer him money, which he couldn't refuse, but he said that he would hire Theo as the personnel director of Playboy. And that kind of, you know, the two big salaries and the place to live in Chicago, you know, they enjoyed it. And he transformed the magazine.
Right, so that would be...
He was the guy who... It was Speck who made the magazine, you know, what it became at its utmost, you know, potential.
Right,
he knew all the literary people in the country.
From New York.
From New York,
yeah.
What I mean. And on the other hand, he had very good ideas. Like, it was his idea that as soon as the articles were accepted, he would send out letters to people in that field, and he would say, here's an article that we're going to publish in, you know, like 3 months from now. We'd very much appreciate your comments on it. Then he'd get those letters, and he'd make them into letters to the editor.
Ah.
Now, they would be like, if it was a psychological piece, you know, the biggest psychiatric names in the country, or if it was political, he'd write to the president, and, you know, and in those days, you never believed who was writing letters to the editor.
Right.
Great ploy, right?
So I'm just looking up him in the wiki. I can't find, just get an idea of how old he is. Is he your age or older?
He was older than I, and he's been dead for a long time. Spectorsky. Spectorsky.
Right, it's August C. Spectorsky.
Right.
And it doesn't seem to have an entry on him.
Uh-huh.
August Spectorsky, no. So, yeah. Let me see, was Robert Anton Wilson working that early at Playboy? I don't think he was.
No, he wasn't.
Did you ever meet him?
Not so much later, but I never really knew him.
Right. So, how long do you do this work for Playboy, which must be 57, 58? Is it for a year?
A few years.
And that's just one thing. You're doing the PR for...
No. Yeah, that's right. I'm doing PR for restaurants and fashion designers and publishing houses and so forth and so on. Yes.
Are you writing poetry?
Yes. Not a hell of a lot, but I am writing poetry, yes.
Is that...
And we, And by the time Ann and I get together, we're publishing something called Poems in Folio.
Right. And that's in one of your... One of them is your work.
No.
No?
No. I mean, it was my idea, first of all, that I and my poet friends would do a one broadside a month, you know, each of us. And Anne loved the idea of the broadsides, but she took it into some other world. First of all, she talked me into that each broadside would be done by a fine printer. You know, San Francisco was the home of a whole bunch of really fine printers, you know, the small people with letter presses, and the biggest one was the Grabhorn Press, and she knew the Grabhorns, and then she decided we should have, you know, prominent poets, and we needed a board of editors, and she had been a student, and also she had an affair with Stanley Kunitz, so Stanley was on our board, and Richard Wilbur was kind of a family fourth cousin or something of hers. He was on the board, and I can't remember.
What about Ted Rutke? Wasn't she a student?
I don't think we did. She studied with him, but he did contribute a poem. He was one of the. I think we issued 11 of them. We never got to the 12th one. I have them. I have copies of them. But you know, the first one was William Carlos Williams with the Sappho translation done by the Grabhorn Press. Anyway, we had not enough subscribers, and we had a few donors, and it was a really good idea, and it didn't last. But we had a good time with it while it did.
And that those 11, they would come out over 11 months, once a month?
One a month, yeah. And yeah. And with the subscription, you got a folder that held all of them, a very nice folder, you know, a big portfolio kind of thing that you got with the first poem.
Did you have copies of these?
I have copies of them, yeah.
Yeah.
I sold all the, except one, I think, signed edition to a rare book dealer before I left California many years ago, named Henry Wenning from Connecticut, who's no longer alive.
You but, sold all of them but one? Is that what you
told me? No, all but one of the signed edition.
Oh.
I still have lots of the unsigned edition.
All right, so yeah. I'm looking at my notes here, and just reference, Madeline is the cartoon or whatever, that the girl who lived in a hotel, that Anne's life was similar. Madeline is the name of the character.
The Bebelmans? I don't know.
Madeline is the little girl who... Is it little stories or little cartoons of her? She's the girl who lives
they're
in...
They're not cartoons, they're illustrations. But is it Ludwig Bebelman?
No, I just see Madeline. I just have Anne and Madeline, the girl who lived in a hotel.
I don't remember it being Madeline. I should have remembered what the name was, but I don't.
The other thing is... when you did the Purple Onion with Kingston Trio and Maya, you mentioned Mort Saul.
Well, Mort was playing at the Hungry Eye. He didn't play the Onion.
Oh, okay.
I knew Mort and his wife, and later on his wife lived with the clarinetist and the Brubeck Quartet.
Mort's wife lived with him.
Mort's wife, they parted, yeah.
Did you watch, you know, they say that Mort got screwed up over the Kennedy assassination and his humor went downhill because he got obsessed with the JFK assassination. Do you know anything about that period in his life, or did he experience any of it?
Not really. I mean, hey, Mort's still alive, and he did a gig in New York. I wish I had known just a few weeks ago, and I would have gone.
Well, he must be pretty old. I just... check him. Oh, no, he's only a year older than you, 1927.
Uh-huh.
They say he's credited with pioneering a style of stand-up comedy that paved the way for Lenny Bruce, Nichols and May, and Dick Gregory.
I don't think that's true, but he was more in the world of Shelley Berman and Professor Corey and that world.
Right.
Dick Gregory, he wasn't anything like Dick Gregory, and he certainly had nothing about him that was like anything that Lenny did.
McLuhan comments on Mort Saul, how he brought one medium into another environment. He brought the newspaper into the nightclub,
yes,
and just by reading stories, it evoked a lot of laughter.
I think maybe Marshall and I went with Howard to hear Mort. It's possible.
Right.
It's possible.
Okay, then. The other thing is Harry Smith must come into your life in this 52 to 55 period in San Francisco, right? Through the poetry scene?
No, I think.
You describe going into his place, tiptoeing into.
Yeah, but it was me and Philip LaMancia. But I have a feeling it was earlier.
Well, his anthology, famous anthology, comes out around 51 or so. When you knew him, did you know about that work that he created?
No, not at all. I mean, does it say when he was a San Francisco Examiner photographer, which is when I knew him?
Right, it says the anthology comes out in 52 in Folkway Records, back in his own career, Eccentric and Bohemian. What is it? What's the name of the paper?
San Francisco Examiner.
See if that's here. No, it doesn't show it.
I don't remember about the anthology coming out at that time, but when I met him, he had one of those big press cameras with the flash.
Yeah.
And he worked for the Examiner. And he lives in this black hotel in the Fillmore District. And Philip LaMancia and I went to Jimbo's Bop City. And Harry had done a big mural on the walls of Jimbo's Bop City. And he had made a deal that he got free food for the rest of his life. Making this mural, right? And he got to choose what he was going to eat, and what he loved was cassava melon. So Jimbo always had to have cassava melon for him.
What's that? Cassava melon?
Cassava is a kind of a melon. It's not a cantaloupe, and it's not a honeydew. It's a cassava.
Okay.
And so he was eating cassava melon, and we sat down with him, and he started talking to us. He knew Philip, and he said, you know, I want to show you my work, but you'll have to come to my hotel with me after we finish here. So when we finished there, they had music at Bop City. And there was an extra room where they had music. But so we went up the street to his hotel, and he made us take our shoes off. We walked up the steps until a halftime. We couldn't say a word until we got back down on the street, so we had to tiptoe up the stairs, long flight of stairs. He opened up his room with a key, didn't turn on the lights. He took out a flashlight, and he put this work down on the floor and pointed the flashlight at it. And it was very interesting stuff that he was doing. Now, we weren't there very long, and when we got back down to the street, we asked him, what was that all about? And he said, on either side of me, there's a pair of black hookers, and they're working for either the FBI or the Secret Service or somebody. there telling them every move that I make. So I'm very quiet, and I don't allow them to know anything, and I never turn on the lights at night.
And is he known? I guess he was known as a paranoid later.
Yes, he was, and an alcoholic.
So did you interact with him much in the later years?
Well, yeah, during the psychedelic years, he was around quite a lot. In fact, the last time I saw him was at the psychedelic theater, which we did with, you know, Leary, et cetera.
Yeah.
And we had, Timothy and I had made a deal that nobody was going to get in free. Didn't matter who they were, you know, friends, press, because we were, it was a benefit for them, for the Millbrook scene, you know.
Yeah.
Castalia Foundation. And we had to get some expenses out of it, so. The second night, I think, Harry comes and he's screaming and he's drunk. He says, I know these, I know all these guys. I mean, if they don't let me in for free, I'm going to make a big ruckus. So I said to Tim, hey, Tim said, I don't want to hear it. I know Harry, but we're not letting anybody in free. So I paid his way in because I knew otherwise we were going to have nothing but trouble. And in the middle of the show, he started screaming.
Wow. That's the last time you saw him.
That's the last time I ever saw Harry. I just lent his Kabbalistic tree, the Tree of Life, to the show at the Pompidou, which is Costa Sacra.
Right.
He gave it to me. It's a print, but it was a fairly limited edition. I don't know how many, but he gave me one of them a long time ago.
Yeah, it says here, talking about his experimental film work, themes of mysticism, surrealism, and data were common elements in his work. Information, especially about Smith's early films, is very contradictory. This is partly due to the work-in-progress nature of experimental filmmaking, and his films are often re-edited, hence the different runtimes. Occasionally incorporating reassembled footage of different films or showed with varying music tracks.
I have them at an anthology film archives in New York.
Right. It says, for instance, the handmade films now known as number 1, 2, 3, and 5 were accompanied by an improvising jazz band on May 12, 1950 when they were premiered as part of the Art and Cinema series curated by Smith's friend Frank Stauffacher at the
Stauffacher. Yeah.
At the San Francisco.
Very nice guy.
Right, at the San Francisco Museum of Art.
Right.
He initially intended to use Dizzy Gillespie songs. Later he showed the films with random records or even the radio as accompaniment. He stated that the films were made for contemporary music and he kept changing their soundtracks. So that's another aspect of the mixed media movement, doing poetry and...
And you know, his first contribution was all the stuff that the folk music that he recorded down south, which was all on folkways, which was Mo Ash.
Yes.
I knew Mo quite well. He's Sholem Ash's brother.
And who's that? Someone you knew?
Sholem Ash?
Yeah, who's that?
He's a famous Jewish author.
I don't know. Is A-S-H?
A-S-C-H.
Oh, okay. So you knew him in your 40s period?
Who, Mo?
Yeah.
I knew Mo, in the 40s when Jane and I were in New York.
Right.
I first met him, yeah.
So it says the anthology of American folk music Smith made was a compilation of recordings of American folk and country music commercially released at 78 RPM records between 1927 and 1932.
And released?
They were released in 52, but they were records from the 27 to 32 period.
Boy, I didn't realize they were that early, but they weren't released until the 50s, yeah.
Yeah, until 52. And this document, or these records, is generally thought to have been enormously influential on the folk and blues revival of the 50s and 60s, and brought the works of Blind Lemon, Jefferson, Mississippi John Hurt, Dick Justice, and many others to the attention of musicians such as Bob Dylan and Joan Baez, and featured such legendary acts as the Carter Family and Clarence Ashley.
Oh, that's interesting. I wonder how he recorded them. He must have had a cutting lathe that he took with him or somehow.
Well, didn't he just collect them?
No, they're records.
Right, so then the anthology was released in 1952 on Folkways Records as 3 2-LP sets.
Yes. But, I mean, they weren't just written. They were recorded.
Yeah.
You know the technology that existed from 1927 to
32. Right.
Yeah.
They were released at 7-8 RPM in that period.
Sure, but that was the only thing that was released in the 50s. It was before LPs. But the other question is, how did he record them?
It says, selections for this collection were culled by Harry Smith from his amassed personal collection of 78 RPM records.
Oh, okay. So I thought he recorded some of it.
No, he just reissued his own records, I guess. Picked for their commercial and artistic appeal within a set period of time, 1927 to 32.
So they were all commercial recordings?
Yeah. It says Smith chose those particular years as boundaries.
Wow, that's weird, because ever since I knew Harry, I thought he had recorded some of that material.
Well, it says that he chose those particular years as boundaries since, as he stated himself, quote, 1927, when electronic recording made possible accurate music production,
uh-huh,
and 1932, when the Depression halted folk music sales.
Uh-huh. Hey, so that's interesting.
It says, in addition to compiling, Smith also recorded music. Allen Ginsberg's long player, New York Blues, Rags, Ballads, and Harmonium Songs, released in 1981, was captured by Smith at the Chelsea Hotel in 1973. He recorded the first album by the Fugs in 1965,
uh-huh,
recorded and released a multi-LP set of Kiowa Peyote Meeting songs on Folkways, and in the 80s recorded thousands of hours of field recordings for a project called Deonage, D-E-O-N-A-G-E, or Deonage. But see, he was born in 1923, so he'd only be 5 years old when the...
Yeah, so, yeah, I knew he was somewhat older than I. 5 years.
No? Yeah.
Yeah. And he was a character.
Right.
An interesting guy, but couldn't listen to him for very long.
Because he became paranoid, you mean?
Yeah, he had all kinds of problems. He's become a total legend, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Says he died singing in Paola Igliori's arms in room 328 at the Hotel Chelsea in New York City. And his ashes are in the care of his wife, Rosebud Filiu Petet, or Filiu Pite, something like that. Did you ever meet her?
No.
No. Okay, so we're... Hey, Scott, how are you doing? Hope Scott's awake.
Doing good.
So we've gone 2.5 hours. Do you want to go another half hour, Gertie? Okay.
I'm okay.
Okay. So looking at the notes here, we talked about the Seven Stray Cats with Jack Gilbert, and Don't Flee the Scene, Salty.
Yes, it's a puppet play, and The characters are drawn from Kenneth Rexroth and Allen Ginsberg and a couple of other people, and it's a comedy, and Jack and I wrote it, and it was performed to great acclaim at the Sausalito Arts Fair first, and then in San Francisco, and there's a puppeteer named Helga Williamson, who I think was a friend of Jack's. And I have the script of it, but And I used to have the recording, but Richard Wirtz Emerson recorded it. Richard Wirtz Emerson recorded all the San Francisco poets and all the poets that came to the Bay Area from all over the world. He had absolutely professional tape equipment. He was, like, fanatic about quality, and he worked for Shell Oil, and he had a wife, and they lived in Sausalito. And there were a whole bunch of people like him and a guy named Howard Schwartz who worked at the Crimson Camera, or not Crimson, but I can't remember the name of the camera store in San Francisco, and who also published a little poetry magazine. So I kept on trying to get a copy of the tape from Richard, and finally, Philip Lamantia introduced me. This is not ages ago, but it's not, it's probably 10, 12 years ago, to Howard Schwartz's son, who was working at the Chronicle as a reporter. And apparently Howard, his father, committed suicide. And I asked him about Richard Wirtz Emerson. He said, you don't know the story? I said, no, I had no idea what happened to Richard. He said he was fired at Shell, couldn't get another job. His wife left him. He eventually was practically a bum on the streets in San Francisco. He had a room in a rooming house, and eventually either he committed suicide or died, and the landlord threw out all the boxes of tape. None of it is exact. I mean, it was a fucking treasure trove. I can't believe it. I still don't quite believe the story, but who knows what the real story is. You know, there's some things you just can't explore, after 40, 50 years, God knows what.
But he had taped years.
I mean, this guy was a three-piece suit, high up executive, and he had thousands of dollars worth of equipment, Ampex.
And he taped years of poetry.
Yeah, beautiful studio. I mean, everybody that you can think of. You know, Kenneth, of course, Spicer, Duncan, me, Philip, but everybody who came through San Francisco, he would go to the readings and invite them to dinner and record them. Yeah.
So, what is the meaning of this title? Don't flee the scene. The scene.
Oh, it's a song by Lionel Hampton.
Oh, okay.
And we used some of the music, and you understand what it means, right? Don't flee the scene, Salty.
No, I don't know what Salty refers to.
Well, Salty means don't leave when you're mad.
Oh, don't flee the
when
scene.
When you're angry.
I see.
Salty, you know? So, it was a takeoff on Ginsberg and Rex Roth and the whole crowd.
And their fight within the factions, you mean? Or their
no,
answers?
It's just not their fight, but their, you know, the way they carried on. I mean, they both, Kenneth was a very dramatic guy. You know, everything was a pronouncement. And Alan was, you know, he came on pretty strong, too, you know, verbally.
So they would debate? They would argue?
No. They were two characters in the play. I can make a copy for you if you really want it. Or I can maybe dig it out before we do the next session, and I'll read you some of it.
Okay. That is written with Jack Gilbert.
Yeah.
Yeah. And this is done in the Anne London period?
This is done in the Anne London. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. I just checked Madeline. Madeline is a children's book series written by Ludwig Bemelsmann.
Okay, that is
Madeline. You know, I have a note here. I don't know why I'm saying this. It says Richard Emerson still alive. What do you? I said, oh no, I remember now. You were wondering if he was still alive, and that's that's your interview in '96. So you met this Schwartz guy after that, after '96.
Less than probably 10. Just about then, yeah.
Right. It's almost like
I think that at the time we were meeting, Philip was still going to write the introduction to the oral history.
Right. The just a note here. Maya is bisexual. Her trio mother, a dyke who killed a man. Maya is bisexual. That's what you say in the oral thing.
Mm-hmm.
Did she do that while she was with you? Did she have girlfriends?
Well, I don't know about girlfriends. She's,
Okay, now, the next note is Hayakawa and Spectorus and Leon Adams.
Well, Hayakawa I knew through Spectorsky.
Just for the listener, Hayakawa went on to become president of San Francisco University or something, right?
Well, at the time I knew him, you know, he was...
Korzybski. He was in the...
He was Korzybski's main man.
Yeah.
And he was the editor of Etc. magazine.
Yes, Etc. for General...
Which was the magazine of the movement.
Which was called General Semantics. General Semantics,
Exactly. And he published several of my poems in it.
Back then? Back in the 50s?
Yes.
And then you had a falling out because he wanted to edit your poem.
No. He didn't want to edit it. He rejected the image. I think it was the third poem that I submitted to him. I think he published at least two or three. There was an image in the poem which was washed idol.
Yeah.
I-D-O-L. And he said, you know, that's really bullshit. What do you mean washed idol? They don't wash idols. I said, hey, I found this little statue, probably an inch and a half, 2 inches high, of a Buddha in the mud outside of the barge. And I brought it inside and washed it. And that's what I meant when I wrote it in the poem. And he said, you know, it's bad enough you use such an impossible image. Now you're lying to me about how it came, you know. And I said, SI. Why would I lie to you about such a thing?
SI being his initials when you say S. Is that what you call him? SI?
SI, so.
Why would I lie to you?
Yeah, about a thing like that. And he was really pissed. It was ridiculous. I mean, his wife's brother was one of Lloyd Wright's biggest associates.
Frank Lloyd Wright,
And he built their house in Mill Valley, architected it. And he was in charge of the county seat center, you know, up in San Rafael, which was finished after Lloyd Wright died.
You mean Hayakawa's
his brother-in-law. Now, I had a friend named Leon Adams. Leon was the head of the Wine Institute in San Francisco, and he had written wine books, but he also wrote a book, the first computer fish book. He used early computer records to trace the striped bass that was caught in the San Francisco Bay, all over the bay.
Mm-hmm.
Locations and everything and he entered it all, and he came up with patterns about where you could catch fish, especially at certain times, you know. I mean, he had hundreds and hundreds of records of this. Anyway, he had a little fishing boat, which was docked in Sausalito, and I used to go out with him on a weekend, and we would catch striped bass, which is a delicious fish. And after I knew Hayakawa, I asked Leon, we invited him, and he used to come out with us. Now, he was brought up in Canada.
Yeah.
In fact, McLuhan delivered newspapers to his house.
That's right, yes.
Okay. And that came up at NYU when they were both on the podium kind of fighting with each other.
Yeah.
So he used to come, and he brought his knives and the accompaniments. And he would, as soon as we caught a fish, he would slice it up, and we would eat it like sushi, right? I had never had sushi by that time.
Hayakawa would do that. He brought that.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Because he learned how to do that from his father.
That's pretty interesting synchronicity that, you know, McLuhan delivers papers to Hayakawa. Hayakawa eats sushi with you, and then you make McLuhan famous, that then leads the encounter between Hayakawa and McLuhan.
Well, I don't think I made McLuhan famous. It's not my little film. I wouldn't say that.
Well,
I was a big fan of his, and I certainly introduced him to a few people. But,
you did not think that when you introduced him to Gossies that McLuhan would be used by Gossies that way.
No, I didn't. And the other big deal was when I introduced him to Harold Rosenberg, and that worked out pretty good.
Okay, well, that'll be later. I have my note here. First of all, we should say for the listener, Hayakawa becomes famous during the...
He was a senator.
Right, but that's...
After this president, and, you know, he was pilloried at San Francisco State.
Yes, when he was the president of the university in whatever it was, San Francisco, he took on the radical students at the time.
Yes, he did.
And for some reason, his image didn't do well in that battle.
No, it sure didn't. I mean, people hated him. He behaved very badly. And he behaved badly as a senator, too.
Right. It says, Hayakawa became popular with mainstream voters in this period after he pulled the wires out from the speakers on a student van at an outdoor rally, dramatically disrupting it. And he was elected as a Republican senator in 76. So you, again, here's someone 20 years before, 56, 57, you're with him in a boat, and you never would imagine he'd be a senator.
No, and I never imagined he'd be a bad guy to me or to anybody else, but he had a terrible temper.
Right, and he was a fascist critic in the sense that if he didn't like your image, he'd say you're out, and you never published again with him.
That's right.
Yeah. But that
in fact, I don't think I ever spoke to him after that thing. And, you know, and I don't even remember if I told Speck about it.
But it's not a big blow to your career that you're not...
No, not at all. But, you know, it was a blow to my feelings of trying to be truthful. It reminded me of my father, you know.
Yeah.
My father didn't believe a lot of things I told him. It didn't matter whether they were true or not.
Yeah, and Hayakawa was born 22 years before you, 1906, 5 years older than McLuhan. He was a professor at San Francisco State College.
Mm-hmm.
Which reminds me, they mentioned in the same sense Stephen Gaskin. Did you know that hippie leader, Stephen Gaskin? Did you ever meet him?
I know all about him. I think we've crossed paths. But he wasn't a friend of mine.
Right.
That's the place still exists down south, right? Stone. She's in the Space Staff book.
In the what?
Which just came out. The book which just came out by Alastair Gordon called Spaced Out.
Ah.
It has a lot about us go in it, and it has this kind of stained glass dome in it, which is done by this woman who lived, and she still visits the farm, and the dome is on the farm.
Ah. Okay, anybody notes here in that period of Hayakawa, we have Frank DeMarco and Ernie's, and Alexis is Tangier. I'm not sure what I'm referring to there. Frank DeMarco, is that
okay, who? I'll tell you exactly what. I told you Herb Kane said he would take care of me and introduced me to Frank DeMarco. Frank DeMarco took me to Ernie's, which was his principal account.
Ah, right, right.
And he took me around. He introduced me to other people. I wrote the piece, and Playboy loved it, you know. So at the end of this thing, the article comes out, and all the people who I mentioned were, you know, I mean, they would cast me out. So Frank calls me up. He says, Gerard, I know that the reason you wrote the article was that you didn't have a job and you don't have... I have an idea. I can only represent one big restaurant in San Francisco because, you know, the money's good, number one, and number two, they don't want me representing their competition, which is understandable. Now, I have the names of at least three or four people who are looking for me to be their representative, but if I tell them that you're the right person and you show them the article, they'll hire you. We want to do it? I said, hey, you think I could do it? He says, of course, I'll help you. So I got Alexis Tangier, which was probably the restaurant, you know, the most expensive and the most weird restaurant in San Francisco. I got Sabella's of Marin, you know, which was having a lot of troubles. And of course, Herb, if I would give Herb items for his column, he would print them, you know. We're friends.
Herb Kane,
so,
yeah.
Yeah, so I was in the public relations business, boom. And I had, after a while, I had five or six clients, and each of them paid a few hundred dollars a month, and each of them, I could bring people for free dinners whenever I wanted to, and, I did some really weird promotions for Sabella's and Marin. I entered a frog in the Calaveras County Frog Jeopardy contest, and it was, you know, made newspaper headlines all over the country. The new restaurant, I had it christened with waters from the seven seas, which were shot out of seven fire truck hoses from different fire companies around, you know, to christen the building, right? I mean, you think the water, people would say, how did you get water from the seven seas? I said, I had it flown in. There were seven different bottles, you know.
Yeah.
I filled them all at the barge.
But that, now this is with Ann, and this would be, now here's just to put in some collective events. Sputnik goes up to 57. Do you remember that?
Yeah. I don't remember the date, but yeah, I remember.
Do you remember what were you doing this? Is this kind of work in 57, 58, or is it 50?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. And Elvis is big, and Elvis is going into the Army around 57, 58. Do you remember that? Drafted in
I never was an Elvis fan.
Did you listen to rock and roll?
Sure, absolutely.
And you liked it?
Yeah, but I preferred jazz and classical.
Right. Now, I have here, in this period, I wanted to ask you this. We mentioned in the last session, about the mafia influence in the clubs and the music business, and you said, well, I didn't know that in the 40s in New York, but I learned that later. Is this the time when you learned that, if there's anything you did learn?
Well, I mean, this guy I was talking about.
With Hefner?
No, not with Hefner. Well, that guy, too, but I don't know what his connections were. But the guy who had the club in the International Settlement.
Oh, yeah, yeah, right.
Yeah, he was connected.
And did you see how they did the mafia run Purple Iron, Purple Onion, or Honey?
No, no, there's nothing, nothing at the Onion and nothing at the... at the Eye. I mean, the Eye was owned by a really, you know, flagrant character named Enrico Banducci. And he also owned the coffee house a couple of blocks away, but that was kind of later, after, even after the Eye closed. But, no, I mean, that, it was a big operation, the Eye, and he operated very well, and you know, he got full houses consistently. And we had very good custom at the Purple Onion. And the guy who managed it, I don't know what the ownership was, but he must have owned some of it. His name was Barry Drew.
Mm.
And he was a Barrymore. And he looked like one. And he was exceptionally gay. And he was later bloody murdered on his houseboat in Sausalito.
In the 60s, 70s, or 80s, when you say later?
Well, I think in the 60s.
Right.
I can't remember. I mean, I'm sure you could look him up, because he was kind of an infamous guy. Barry Drew.
Right.
That's, you know, just Drews, the Drews and the Barrymores were the family.
Okay, so the you don't see the mafia, that the owners of Hungry Eye or Purple Onion have to pay off the mafia.
No.
They didn't. They were too.
I don't know. I don't think so. No.
So you see it. You see the mafia in the more cliche or sleazy places. It's mafia.
Yeah, of course they were running, or they or some people of their ilk were running the International Settlement. No doubt about it. And the girls, and the scambling, and the, you know.
And the menage a trois, the two blondes you were mentioning.
Yeah, that was pretty wild.
So and, the know, mother and daughter, right? That's what they were.
No, they were sisters.
Oh, sisters. Okay.
And they wore these push-up bras, and, you know, you could practically see everything except the nipple.
Okay, so...
I mean, they were babes, so don't get me wrong. They weren't ugly, and they weren't... They took care of themselves, you know.
Yeah.
But it was a gas.
Well, we've done almost 3 hours, but I wanted to bring up the Gurdjieff relationship, if you have anything to say about that.
Oh, okay.
In relation
the
to Jack...
relationship.
To Jack and Mary Taylor.
Yeah, that came through Leon Adams. Leon Adams was the Wine Institute, and he introduced me to the Taylors. He said, look, Gerd, I was already in public relations. He says, look, these people need help. If you can help them, they'll pay you. They'll pay you in wine. They don't have a lot of money, but they're a wonderful couple of people. So he took me up there to Maya Comas, and it's on the slopes of a non-working volcano, right? And Jack Taylor, who also worked for Shell Oil as an engineer of big facilities, refineries, refinery engineer, designer. So he retired, and he bought this slope of volcano, and he terraced it like an Italian terraced vineyard himself on a tractor. And Mary, she made herb mixes, and they're still sold. I think they later retired to Hawaii, and I believe they're both gone. But Mary was an incredible cook, and she was a Gurdjieff person, and she had actually met Gurdjieff, and she introduced me to his books. And
did they interest you?
Who?
Gurdjieff. You had read Uspensky, I think, because we were talking about the...
Yeah. Well, I read Gurdjieff at that time, All and Everything.
Right. Through her. She showed you the book.
Yes, absolutely.
And what did you make of that? You knew it was...
Well, I loved it. I loved the beginning of that book where he says, you know, in Tiflis, there was this huge clock on the tower of the, I think, the railroad station, and every morning at a certain hour, it would make tremendous noise, and it woke up all the people who had to get up and go to work. The problem was it woke up all the other people who didn't have to go to work also, you know. It was that kind of a, you know, that's a parable.
Yeah.
You know, and I love those parables, so I kept on reading it. And he was some character.
Did she tell you some stories about Gurdjieff?
Yes, she did, and she also turned me on to another book by one of his students who kind of took care of him, and the funny story in that was that he said he used to have to clean up Gurdjieff's bedroom, and he said, of course, he understood about the empty bottles of Armagnac, which what's the apple liquor called, the French apple liquor, which was strewn around the room. But what he never could understand is the footprints on the ceiling. You know, I mean, it's those kind of things that, you know.
And they'd be up there, he'd have to clean the room, and they'd be often footprints on the ceiling.
Yes.
Wow. Well, it's been sweet.
Well, you know, Gurdjieff was known as an exceptionally active womanizer.
Yeah. Okay. Does that remind you of anything, Scott, about Gurdjieff? Since you know a little bit about Gurdjieff, I think.
I'm good.
Okay. So let's. Gerd, it's been 3 hours. Think we should stop?
Sure.
Take a break.
Take a break.
Take a week-long break. Now, next week is July... Okay, that's not a holiday. It's holiday weekend. Are you going away or anything? July 4th weekend?
Not that I know. No.
Okay, good.
If somebody takes me away, I'll go.
All right. Well, if you don't go, we'll meet again. And we've sort of done the 20s, 30s, and 40s in installment one. We've done a good chunk of the 50s, and we're heading back. We're going to go back to New York soon in 1960-61, right?
I guess.
Right. Okay, Scott, have you stopped the tape?
No, we're going to sign off right now.